My name is Vic Veer. I'm an ENT consultant surgeon. I'm the head of the sleep surgery department at the Royal National ENT Hospital in central London, UK. My job as an ENT surgeon is to help people with obstructive sleep apnea, more from a surgical standpoint, but I do try to provide a slightly more holistic approach because our team is such that we have all sorts of specialties to help people with obstructive sleep apnea, snoring, upper airway resistance syndrome, obesity, hyperventilation syndrome, etc. This is actually my second podcast episode. The first one I did was all about an overview of obstructive sleep apnea, sleep disturbance, what this condition is all about, what are the signs and symptoms and things like that, and eventually I ended up with treatment. During that rather long episode, what I did was I talked about something known as drug-induced sleep endoscopy, which is the focus of this episode today. Many people may understand about drug-induced sleep endoscopy, but I'm going to go right from the basics. And what I want to do is explain this in a lot of detail because there are a lot of misconceptions about drug-induced sleep endoscopy, and I really want people to understand it and the benefits of it. Also want to explain how I've modified it over the years and why I think my technique might be beneficial, particularly in my patients anyway. I'm also going to talk about the pros and cons of drug-induced sleep endoscopy. So there is a lot of detail in here, and at the end I'll talk about how the information gained from this investigation can help towards our treatment of this disease. So, firstly, what is drug-induced sleep endoscopy? This is a technique for working out why you have obstructive sleep apnea. So, I'll go back a step. Obstructive sleep apnea is when you sleep at night, you start snoring, because a lot of people snore, up to 45%, 48% of people snore. In some cases, there is no breathing whatsoever because everything's completely blocked up, and therefore you lose a little bit of oxygen. The body can't tolerate losing too much oxygen, obviously, and therefore wakes you up so you can take that deep breath again, open up your airway, but then the cycle repeats itself, and that's known as obstructive sleep apnea. Apnea meaning a blockage of breathing. Obstruction is obviously an obstruction in your airway because there are things like central sleep apnea and other things as well. Now, this is investigated or tested by something known as a sleep study or a polysomnography. This is a machine that's basically strapped onto your chest or onto the side of your hand, and it monitors your oxygen levels, your respiratory rate, how often you breathe, that is, how loud your snoring is, and all sorts of things. And the idea is that at the end of that night of investigation, this machine has its information downloaded. We examine it. We work out whether or not you have obstructive sleep apnea. But the point is that this only really tells us how bad your sleep apnea is. It tells you, for example, that you stop breathing 20 times an hour, for example, which is rather bad. That's moderate obstructive sleep apnea. And it can tell you how low your oxygen levels were, or how loud your snoring is, or how bad your snoring or obstructive sleep apnea is in different positions of sleep. Say, a lot of people sleep much better on their side compared to their back. So there's all sorts of things that it can tell you, but it can't tell you why you have obstructive sleep apnea. It can't tell you why you have this thing known as upper airway resistance syndrome. So the idea of a drug-induced sleep endoscopy is to provide that information to tell us, okay, I know I stop breathing, say, 20 times an hour, but why is that happening? What is going on in my throat that's causing this obstruction? Now, there are lots of different ways of doing this. And traditionally, people, what they did was they brought a patient into the clinic, looked into their mouth, looked into the back of their nose, used something known as a flexible nasendoscopy. That's a little sort of fiber optic telescope that looks into your nose and then turns down and looks down in the back of your throat and has a good look around at your tongue, at your tonsils, your throat, your voice box, your nose, all sorts of places. That's quite useful. It doesn't, however, give, or it doesn't give most people the information you really need to work out why you have sleep apnea, because you may have very large tonsils, which is a very good indication, but most people don't have huge tonsils when they come to see me or other surgeons about this, because someone would have picked that up already. You can see that just by looking into your mouth. The difference is that when you look into someone's throat in the clinic, well, it looks relatively normal. Most people look relatively normal. You might have an indication, oh, your tongue looks large or something like that, but it doesn't really tell you what's going on because the patient isn't asleep at that time. They're just sitting there, breathing away relatively normally. They're not snoring in front of you. So how can you really work out what's going on during sleep? Because the throat changes a lot at night, and there's more what we'd say collapsibility. The throat sort of collapses down in people with obstructive sleep apnea. It's very hard to tell that when someone's wide awake, not snoring, not having sleep apnea in your clinic, possibly quite anxious and nervous and scared as well when they're putting the telescope up your nose. So it's not that useful. It can be useful, as I said, in some cases with, say, a very blocked nose, which tells you some information. Or you could have big tonsils, as I said before, or a big tongue, something like that. But there's no way I would really operate on someone. I say, well, looks like you've got a big tongue. Let's remove some of that. It becomes a very much a sort of trial and error problem. So I said, well, you know, this is the operation I normally do. If that doesn't work, I'll try this operation. That's not the way I can work, particularly on the NHS. My waiting list is quite long, and I can't really afford to bring people back and forth until I get the operation that they really need. What I need to do is target and find out exactly what the problem is before I give them treatment, because you might end up with lots of complications from unnecessary operations. I need to know exactly where the problem is. Some other people try to use scans. Some people do CT scans or x-rays of the throat, side view typically. The trouble is that CT scans, MRI scans, they don't really tell you much about the airway. You're awake almost all of the time, and again, the same problem occurs if you're awake, sitting up or lying down on a scanner. You can keep the tone in your throat. You can see the airway may be slightly narrow in some places, but anyone can move their tongue back or forward and can disrupt the results of these investigations. The other thing is that even with MRI and high resolution MRI, you can't really tell different types of tissue. So for example, you may have very large tonsils or a lingual tonsil. That's a tonsil that's sitting on the back of your tongue. But when you look with a MRI scan, all you'd see would be the tongue and a lump on the back of it. You wouldn't see any difference between the tongue muscle and the tonsil. So you don't really know what to do in a situation with a big tongue, because there are different operations for different parts of the throat. If I saw a tongue with a big lingual tonsil sitting on the back of it, I'd say, oh, well, your main problem seems to be the tongue because it's got a large amount of lingual tonsil at the back. If we shrunk that down, that would be fine. But on an MRI scan, I can't tell if that's tongue muscle or lingual tonsil because they look the same. They just look grey on the MRI scan. And it also only gives you typically a 2D view, a side view or a front view. It doesn't show what actually happens when the throat collapses in, what part of the throat is collapsing in, because it's only in 2D. You need to be able to see it in 3D so you can see exactly what's going on in there. And it doesn't tell you where the snoring's coming from either, because it's almost like a snapshot in time. An MRI scan is a static single picture basically of the airway, or a CT scan is a single picture of the airway. It doesn't really tell you where the flutter is or what sort of flutter it is. And that's the sort of thing I need to know as a surgeon. If I can see that the palate is fluttering away, I need to know what sort of flutter. Is it the whole part of the palate, or is it just the mid portion? Is it because it's falling in a hammock formation? All of that information you can't get from a scan. So that makes that investigation rather difficult as well. So it doesn't give me the information. Well, nothing I can say, ah, well, I've got enough information now. I can now operate knowing that I've done everything I can to work out what's going on. Doesn't feel right to me. Anyway, what I want to talk about is this drug-induced sleep endoscopy. And the way this was borne out was in our institution at the Royal National ENT Hospital in central London. Actually, at the time, it was called the Royal National Throat, Nose and Ear Hospital. This was in Gray's Inn Road near King's Cross in North London, North Central London. So there was a chap called Mr. Croft and his registrar, Mr. Pringle, and they invented this technique called drug-induced sleep endoscopy. What they did was they lay people down on the operating table and they gave them a drug to make them partly fall asleep. Well, not really fall asleep, partly anaesthetize them. And when you only partly anaesthetize someone, the airway collapses slightly and recreates that snoring noise that we all know. And then what he did was he looked down the back of the throat whilst they were partly anaesthetized and found that, oh, the snoring seems to be coming from this area or this area. It seems to be different in different people. And so he thought about this and thought, maybe we could use this to target where we should be operating for these patients. And since then, the whole world has basically used Croft and Pringle's technique of drug-induced sleep endoscopy to give a partial anaesthesia for people to recreate a state similar to sleep, so we can examine the back of the throat and see where snoring is coming from during real sleep. Now, I have my issues with this type of technique, and I'll come back to that in a minute. It's a thing called natural sleep endoscopy. This is the thing that Croft and Pringle were trying to get away from. So natural sleep endoscopy is when you bring someone in, probably quite late at night on the ward, put the same flexible fibroscope into their nose and examine the back of their throat and sit there waiting for the patient just to fall asleep in front of you. Eventually, if you wait long enough, and sometimes it could take a very long time, an hour or so, the patient would just fall asleep with this telescope up your nose. Then we could see really what's going on there during real sleep. You can see where the flutter is coming from. You can see where the throat is collapsing. And that's really quite useful for us to know where the problems are so we can target our surgery, as I said before. The problem is that takes a very long time. You can only do one or two of these procedures each night, depending on how quickly people fall asleep. And it's not very convenient. Doctors don't want to come in every night at about 12, 1 o'clock in the morning and wait for people to fall asleep. Often people don't fall asleep. They're so anxious with this telescope up their nose. It's rather difficult to get them into a state that they would fall asleep. So this is why Croft and Pringle created this system where they would give a partial anaesthetic to recreate a state similar to that. Now, around the world, people are using drug-induced sleep endoscopy before doing any operations on the throat because they want to know exactly where the problem is. And it is a good technique, and a lot of people use it. Weirdly, not many people in the UK use it. It seems to have come out of favour for a long time. But in the last 10 years, more and more people, even in the United Kingdom, are starting to use drug-induced sleep endoscopy because they're starting to see, yes, the evidence is out there and it is useful, because in most cases, you can see that what's going on and you have a little bit more reassurance that the operation you're about to do is the right thing to do. But also the stipulation from hypoglossal nerve stimulators, which is this implant that goes into your chest or into your chin that helps you fix obstructive sleep apnea. This technique, which I'm not going to go into much detail today, there are videos on my YouTube channel about this if you would like to look at that. This device really cannot be put in unless you've had a drug-induced sleep endoscopy first. And now that the evidence is out there that you must have this as a stipulation before you put an implant in, more and more people are beginning to realize, actually, yes, a drug-induced sleep endoscopy is useful. Because even in the people where, we've done a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, we've worked out that this person is not eligible for an implant to fix their obstructive sleep apnea, they think to themselves, okay, they're not eligible, but what are they eligible for? What other operations could we give this person? And so that's quite useful, because people are now starting to realize the benefit of this technique. So over the years, people more and more are doing this investigation, even in the UK, and it's become a massive thing. There are now thousands of papers on drug-induced sleep endoscopy, so the evidence is out there. I still am not particularly keen on the way a lot of people do it, and I'll explain that in more detail now. Firstly, I think the main criticism of this technique is that it's not really sleep. It's an anaesthetic state, which is close or partly representative of sleep. My problem is that if you give a drug, a anaesthetic drug, to anyone, you can make them snore, because what you're doing is you're partly collapsing the airway. And so I don't think this is a very good technique, because you're not really showing exactly what they're doing during real sleep. Basically, you're doing is giving them a little bit of anaesthetic and making them snore. So I'm not a real fan of this, to be honest. And when it says drug-induced sleep, you're not really providing sleep. You're providing an anaesthetic state. It'll be drug-induced state endoscopy or something like that. And when I started my job, I was really worried that I was basing all of these operations on this technique, and it wasn't really sleep. So I, at the start of my job, thought to myself, oh, this was over 10 years ago now, how can I make this better? How can I be sure that what I'm seeing is correct? And so I did that thing where I explained earlier, the natural sleep endoscopy. I brought people into hospital relatively late at night, and I said, look, tomorrow will be your drug-induced sleep endoscopy, but tonight what I'd like to do is try and do it without any drugs. So typically I had to pick people who were very, very tired, who'd fall asleep very easily in front of me. And so what I did was I got them to lie down in their hospital bed at night. I put the telescope in, and then we had a little bit of chit chat with the lights partly turned off. And if you're very, very tired, people will just fall asleep eventually. Some people made me wait an awful lot of time, and I only did about 20 of these in the end, but I could see exactly what was going on in the back of their throat during real sleep. I thought, well, this is great data. Do I really need to do the thing that tomorrow? But I said, the only way I could hold a good sort of service is to get through enough patients. And so I had to do the drug-induced sleep endoscopy the next day, and I wanted to compare the two. And what I realized was that when you do a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, it's not quite the same as real sleep. And I realized this difference, and I thought, wow, this is worrying me, because I don't want to start operating on parts of people's throats unnecessarily. And what I found was that, yes, you could make anyone snore with a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, but even if you followed all the guidelines, use a what we call a target-controlled infusion of propofol. Propofol is a drug which causes anesthesia. Even if you use this technique, just as it says in all the papers and all the publications out there, I found that compared to natural sleep endoscopy, there was a greater propensity for the tongue to fall back, because it's a muscle relaxant. The tongue is a huge muscle, and because most people do this procedure when lying on your back, the tongue sort of falls back because gravity is letting it drop back, and other areas of the throat weren't coming into play because of it. Now, this didn't happen to all of my patients. In most cases, it looked almost identical to natural sleep endoscopy. And I was sort of glad about that, because I didn't want to be doing a procedure which wasn't any good at all. But I was interested in how it was affecting the tongue base more than it should, or more than I saw during natural sleep endoscopy. So then I thought to myself, how can I make this technique any better? And when you look at the pharmacology of propofol, this is the drug that we use to get people into the anesthetic state. I thought, well, why are we giving a transfusion? Why don't we just see if we give a much smaller dose, just a tiny dose, and see what happens? And what I realized was that people would wake up after about 4, sometimes 6 minutes after giving one shot of propofol, because it comes out of your system very quickly. The way propofol works is that it's injected into your vein through the arm typically. It goes around your body, and initially it goes straight into your brain and causes an anesthetic effect. This works very quickly. That's why we use it to start off an anesthesia in most people, even, you know, all around the world. Most people use propofol to start off an anesthesia, and sometimes they can carry on with it with an infusion, or they go on to gases or other types of anesthesia. But a lot of people use it because the risks are very low with this drug. The side effect profile is very low, and it just seems to work. And it's very, I've not yet found a person who's allergic to propofol. So it's a great drug for that reason. But interestingly, it only lasts 4 to 6 minutes, meaning that once it's gone into your brain, causes an anesthetic effect, it starts redistributing in your body throughout normally the fat layers around your body and comes out of your brain. And so the clinical effect of propofol comes out very quickly. And with it sitting in your fat layers around the body, it can cause a bit of a sedative effect with it in there if you give it for long enough, because it's sort of sitting in your system for a period of time. They say it stays in your system for about 2 days before it gets excreted out. But the less you give of this drug, obviously the less of the sedating effect you have. And I thought to myself, well, why don't we use the fact that it is such a quick onset and quick offset type drug? The effect starts very quickly, and then the effect comes off very quickly. Because my plan was to use the drug to put someone into an anesthetic state, just as most people normally do, and then put the telescope up into their nose and then sit there and just wait. So my anesthetist at the time, who I still work with now, Jim Roberts, or James Roberts, who's a fantastic anaesthetist. He was head of the department, and he got lumbered with me and had to do all my operations with me. He actually quite likes it now because it's challenging, difficult work, operating on sleep apnea patients, because they're very, very sort of challenging airways and difficult to put tubes in. So it makes him a better anaesthetist, I guess, and he uses it to teach other trainees how to deal with really, really difficult cases. But anyway, that's beside the point. He and I figured out that if we just gave one small amount of propofol, enough time for me to look up the nose and put my flexible scope into an area which would not wake someone up, and then just wait for the effect of that drug to wear off. And then eventually, if you waited long enough, people would be sleeping rather than anaesthetized, because the effect has pretty much worn off. Now, you can't really put it in, only put a tiny amount just for you to fall asleep for a few minutes, for a second or so, because putting a telescope up someone's nose would wake you up. It's only once the telescope is sitting in your nose and lying still do people not realize that it's a problem. It's a bit like having those feeding tubes in your nose. You see some poor children who have feeding tubes because they've got chemotherapy and things like that, and they can sleep with that, and they have it in for several months at a time sometimes. Once it's in place, it doesn't seem to bother you. But pushing a telescope up your nose, like a COVID test or something, would definitely wake someone up if they were sleeping. The idea is to anaesthetize someone for as short a time as possible, enough time, maybe 30 seconds really, for me to get my telescope into place. And then what I said to Jim, we're just going to sit here for as long as we possibly can. And he said, look, by 10 minutes, pretty much all of the effect has worn off. I said, well, I just want to see what happens. Sometimes I made him sit there for 45 minutes, and obviously he got very upset with me. But we just sat there because the effect of the drug had worn off. My telescope was in place looking at the back of someone's throat. And what we were doing is watching someone's throat once the effect of the propofol has worn off. We had to realize that we turned off all the lights in the operating room. We turned off all the beeping noises that the anaesthetist's machine would make. We had to stop people from walking in and out of the operating room because that would wake people up. And we give them a relatively comfy bed. We wouldn't put them on an operating table, which is quite hard and firm. We gave them the normal bed that they'd have in the hospital beds rather than an operating table. So we made it as comfortable as possible with almost like a duvet over them. What the plan was, that we give them the anesthetic, that effect would wear off, the telescope would be in place. And as long as we didn't wake people up after the anesthetic effect had worn off, people just carry on sleeping because there's nothing really to wake them up. It's born out of an effect that if you put someone into a dark bedroom in the middle of the afternoon, say 2 o'clock in the afternoon, nearly everyone will fall asleep within about 20 minutes or so. And people will sleep for an hour or so until they're woken up again. And it's, useful to have that information, because then we can say, well, most people will fall asleep if given the opportunity. They don't really want to because it messes up their daily routine. And they may not be tired at all. Even normal people will fall asleep in the afternoon. But it gives us an opportunity to see what's going on at the back of their throat. So we really are enjoying reducing sleep. We're not recreating a state similar to sleep by an anesthetic. So the idea is that we're just watching them sleep after the anesthetic has been given. And I, as I said, I waited 45 minutes. I was waiting to see how long this would go on for. And eventually, I would accidentally move my arm because it got tired, or someone would cough, or accidentally someone would say something outside our operating table that would wake up the patient. And typically, the patient would sit up and go, oh, I'm so sorry, I fell asleep. I really didn't mean to fall asleep. Can we start the procedure now? I didn't mean to do that. And so they were very embarrassed, but we were obviously very happy, because that doesn't happen with normal drug-induced sleep endoscopy. People don't wake up and go, oh, I didn't realize I'd fallen asleep, because they're anaesthetized. They're not really in a sleep sort of situation. When I use my technique, they do actually sleep, it seems. I mean, I'm not saying this is perfect by any means. There's still a small effect of the propofol that was given 15, 20 minutes ago, but it seems much closer to real sleep if they can suddenly wake up and say, oh, I didn't realize I fall asleep, because it means that they're completely conscious at that point. They wake up and they go, ah, the effect of the anesthetic seems to have worn off relatively quickly. They seem not to be under the influence of the anesthetic drug at all. And if I compared that to the standard technique, which is to use an infusion of propofol and try and recreate that partially collapsed airway effect, these people lie on their back. You can turn their head left and right. You can roll them over. You could transfer them from one bed to the other and they still wouldn't wake up. Now, that doesn't really happen in real life. If you're really asleep, that really wouldn't happen. And when you look at the throat of someone who's having an infusion of propofol, what you're seeing is a partly obstructed airway, and each breath is roughly the same. But when you watch someone with a natural sleep endoscopy, each breath isn't the same. And, people who watch their partners with obstructive sleep apnea would see this as well. You typically have a huge breath, and then you start having your big breath to try and get the oxygen back, and slowly you go back into a deeper sleep, and the throat gets slowly, slowly more blocked up, and eventually it blocks off altogether. You have to wait 10, 15 seconds. You worry about, oh, maybe we should just prod them to wake them up again. And then they take this huge breath again, and then the cycle repeats itself, sometimes over each minute. Would be slightly different, perhaps, because what you're seeing is people falling deeper and deeper into sleep, and then them taking a huge breath to overcome the obstruction so they can clear the oxygen problems that they've just had. And you don't see that with drug-induced sleep endoscopy using a TCI infusion. What you're seeing is just a partly obstructed airway, and people are just desperately trying to breathe, and each breath is the same. But when they're really asleep, people make an effort to try and compensate for any oxygen loss. You don't do that in drug-induced sleep endoscopy with a infusion of propofol, because all you're doing is increasing or decreasing the collapsibility of the airway. You're not really creating something that would mean that the patient is trying to maintain their own airway. So I've noticed this over the years that it seems much more like real sleep because they are actively trying to breathe when they've lost oxygen, but also they want to go back into deep sleep again afterwards. So you see this cycle, which is why often I spend a lot longer on a drug-induced sleep endoscopy than other people. And also, actually, my technique is an awful lot harder because we've got to keep everyone asleep, and it's very hard to not wake someone up with a big telescope up their nose because generally people roll over in bed. They don't stay lying on their back like a vampire all night. They roll over and move around, and they sniff, and they yawn sometimes. All these sorts of things happen when people sleep that you don't see in a standard drug-induced sleep endoscopy. And I love the fact that I can see all of that. Sometimes people roll over to their left or right side, and I just have to follow them around to hopefully not wake them up. Because if they do wake up because the telescope's in their nose or someone wakes them up by a noise or something, I have to start the whole process all over again because I want to see what's going on in the back of their throat. But you don't get that real opportunity to see what looks like real sleep within an infusion of propofol. The other benefit, I think, of my technique is that with propofol, as I said, you're not creating sleep, so you never see dreams with a propofol-induced drug-induced sleep endoscopy. All you see is a partly obstructed airway because that's what you've created. But when you put people into what I think is sort of inducing real sleep, but when you induce what I think is real sleep with my technique, you do see people who start dreaming away in front of you. You see their eyes flicking around under their eyelids. And if you wake them up in the middle of that, they go, "Yes, I was having a very vivid dream." And then I thought to myself, well, you cannot dream when you're under the influence of propofol. That to me sounds like real sleep. And so what I saw whilst they were asleep with the fluttering at the back of their throat and the obstructions I saw at the back of their throat, that must have been as close as I possibly can get to real sleep. And so, yes, I'm quite happy with that because seeing someone dream is really important. Some people may go, well, okay, that helps saying that this is real sleep rather than an anesthetic state caused by propofol. But what other benefit is there? The real benefit, I think, is that there are some people out there who only have obstructive sleep apnea during REM or dream sleep. And there's a good reason for this, is because when you go through a dream, you have all these vivid ideas of maybe running around, fighting dragons, or whatever you dream about. But the body doesn't want us to act this out in our sleep. So it makes all our muscles all flaccid. It drops the tone in all our muscles to stop you from acting out these dreams. And so say if you had a tongue-based problem and you're lying on your back, and typically you're slightly worse lying on your back, so your tongue falls back and blocks your breathing slightly. If you were lying on your back and then you suddenly started dreaming, your tongue would fall back even more because there's less sort of tone in the back of your tongue, and you block off even worse, and you block off even more. And therefore, some people at that point get real obstructive sleep apnea, and it's shown up on their studies. I think this is an important condition. I just want to sidetrack a little bit, is because I see an awful lot of people who've been told by other departments, oh, you don't have any obstructive sleep apnea, don't worry, go away. And that's because they're looking at the overall AHI, which would be less than 5. An AHI is the number of times that you stop breathing on average. A lot of people don't have any problems lying on their side, lying on their back. They have no sleep apnea whatsoever. They're below that level of 5 times an hour, or AHI of 5. But only when they dream do they have a problem with obstructive sleep apnea, because the tongue has fallen back or some other problem has occurred because the tone in their throat has gone down. So during that small amount of time that they're dreaming, they get obstructive sleep apnea. It's really quite bad. It causes concentration problems and brain fog during the day. And they feel sometimes very tired. They can't concentrate and deal with things or learn new things, and they become very unproductive. So they come to see their doctor, but their sleep study is normal, and they go, oh, I wonder if it's something else. But if you look carefully at the sleep study, at the graph, rather than looking at those numbers, which are just an average of averages, you can see that when they're dreaming, their oxygen levels drop down very low and they wake up a little bit during those times. But because we don't dream the whole night, it doesn't come up as, isn't registered in the average. So your AHI may be 20 during dreams, but the rest of the time it may be 1. And because it's only about 10% of your sleep, because you keep waking up in between times, in between your dream states, the overall average doesn't go up higher than 5, even though you're severely affected by losing an important part of your sleep. So I think dream sleep, obstructive sleep apnea is really important. And sometimes if that's the only problem, I sit there and wait for people who are having a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, and wait until I can see an area which looks like that they're dreaming, because I can see their eyes flicking around. I can see that they've gone a little bit more flaccid. And then you can see, ah, I wouldn't get this with an infusion of propofol, but I can see it now that I've induced sleep. And typically these people are sort of desperate to dream. They need to be able to dream, because if you starve someone of dreams, that you go into a dream state very, very quickly. So I don't often have to wait longer than 20 minutes typically before someone starts dreaming straight away in front of me. And it's great to see, because then I've seen what really is going on at the back of their throat. So if there are any doctors in the audience of this podcast who are listening to this, the idea that I'd really want to get across is that it's not really a drug-induced sleep if you're using an infusion of propofol. All you're doing is creating a state similar to sleep, or you're just collapsing the airway partially to see which parts of the throat will collapse first. And I don't think that's great, but it certainly isn't a terrible technique, because when I did my natural sleep versus the infusion type of technique, I found that they were quite similar. But for me, being sort of a bit of a perfectionist, I guess, it wasn't good enough for me, which is why I've changed my technique. As I said, it's much, much harder to do my technique. And if you're interested, please do reach out and I'll explain in more detail how we do it. But generally what we do is put a cannula in the arm. We pre-oxygenate people as much as possible. So we give their oxygen levels as high as possibly can before they fall asleep, because there is a short point for about sort of 4 to 6 minutes where we're having to push oxygen into the lungs when they are anaesthetized. I've got my telescope in the right place. We don't want any sort of risk to the patient at all. We want this to be as safe as possible, because the first sort of 10, 15 minutes of this procedure aren't that useful to me at all. I don't really want to see what's going on at the back of your throat during an anaesthetic state. I want to see what sleep is really like. So for the first, particularly sort of 2 minutes when the telescope is in, I pump oxygen into people's lungs. I don't want to see them collapsing and blocking off their airway during that time. It's not important to me. Once the first 2 minutes or so, 4 minutes have gone past, then people are very much breathing by themselves. cells, but they're still under the effect of propofol. If you're starting out with this technique, I would wait 15 minutes and get used to waiting for 15 minutes and then looking at the back of the airway at that point. And you'll see that people drift between different phases of sleep. And then you start picking this up when you're watching people sleep. You get a better appreciation of what goes on during sleep. And you need to be quite mobile, because people do roll over, particularly when they're lying on their back and they're starting to choke a little bit. They start rolling over to one side, and then you have to follow them with them, because you need to make sure that the telescope under the nose doesn't wake them up. It doesn't cause too much pressure because you've not followed them as they move around their head to one side or the other. You do have to make the anesthetic or the theatre room as quiet as possible. You do need a really good stack system, or, you know, the TV, so you can see what's going on in the back of the throat, so you can record what's going on. Some people advocate using other drugs such as midazolam, and there are lots of little drugs that people use. I don't like using midazolam because I've tried these drugs out before, and A, that they have a much longer sort of effect of action. So you have to remember that I'm only using the drug to induce the sleep. I don't want to sit there forever waiting for the effect to wear off. So I want it as short as possible, and luckily propofol has a very short action. But midazolam goes on for many hours in your body. And when I use midazolam, I noticed that the tongue fell back even more than it did with propofol. And because it's sitting there for such a long time, I have to sit there for hours sometimes to wait for the effect of the midazolam to wear off. So it's not a useful technique for me. It does make it much easier to see if you're using midazolam and propofol together, because it makes it much easier to get into that window where you see the airway collapsing slightly. But as you probably worked out from my technique, I'm not trying to recreate an anesthetic state, which is similar to sleep. I'm trying to induce someone to have sleep so they can carry on sleeping until I wake them up by mistake, or by the end of the procedure when I've seen enough and I can just wake them up myself. So there are lots of drugs out there, and I don't particularly like any of them apart from propofol. There are some drugs which are newer and don't cause as much respiratory depression, all those sorts of things. But after trying them all, I haven't found one that is better than propofol. So if you're a doctor out there, I would just stick to a very short acting drug like propofol, and just watch and wait and learn from the throats of your patients. I think it's really, really important to sit there and watch and see what's going on in someone's throats, because it does change. And typically you'll see what looks like, oh, a collapsing airway, the tongue's falling back or something like that. And then you wait until they've sort of gone through about 10 minutes or so. And when you think, yes, if I said their names like, oh, Mr. Jones, are you there? And they'd wake up. When you get to that point, when you know that they would wake up if you woke them up, and you look to the back of the throat, you'll notice actually it is subtly different to what it was like 10 minutes before, when typically people would look. And then you go, right, okay, there is a difference here. And I think it's an important difference in some people. It's not important in everyone. Otherwise, you know, people wouldn't have very good results with this technique at all, and it wouldn't be used. What I'm trying to impress upon you is that you can make this technique even more accurate and even better for your patients, because the more accurate you get with the drug-induced sleep endoscopy, the better your outcomes will be. And certainly that's why I think I'm quite proud of my outcomes. I want to show that I've got better outcomes than anyone else. But I don't think it's because I'm a better surgeon. It's because I think I just watch people sleep a lot longer than other people. The other thing to think about is to have a really good quality sleep study before you have a drug-induced sleep endoscopy. If you have something simple like a WatchPat, or, you know, one of these other sort of simple pulse oximetry type, polysomnography type tests, they're not very useful. You need to see something that shows you AHI in every position, and you need to be able to look at the hypnogram, a very clear hypnogram, the graph that goes through the whole night. You want to see what it's like when you're lying on your back and dreaming, or lying on your back or with your head turned to one side. You want to see not only the AHI or the oxygen saturation loss, you want to see what the flow limitation is, how blocked or how restricted their airway is. You want to be able to see the respiratory rate in each position at different stages of sleep. Most of these sleep studies don't provide you with that data, but if you have a really good quality sleep study, you can see all of that. And so using inferior sleep study doesn't give you that sort of information, so I can't use it for a drug-induced sleep endoscopy because it's just not accurate enough. I personally like a Nox T3S because that can go on for 3 days and gives you really good data. You can look at the breathing as well. Sometimes I use the S Med, which is quite useful. It's not as good somehow as the Nox T3S, as the Nox T3S in terms of the hypnogram, the graph, but it does help you pick up all the other things that could be going on, which you can see with this technique. Again, I'll go back to the comparison between my technique and the infusion technique of propofol. With the infusion technique, you don't see other things going on in people's sleep. For example, you see things like catecholamine or restless leg syndrome. There are other conditions that we see which aren't related to breathing, but are related to this patient's sleep. You don't see any of those things with a propofol infusion, but you do see it when you give a single shot of propofol at the start of the procedure and then wait for them to fall into what looks like a very more normal representative sleep state rather than an anesthetic state. And sometimes that can be really important. I see, oh, some breathing problems, but they're completely overshadowed by the fact that they've got terrible restless legs and it seems to keep waking them up. And then I realize, okay, the sleep study shows you've got some sleep problems or some snoring problems or maybe even sleep apnea, but the main problem you have is the restless legs. Perhaps you should sort that out first. Sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes the restless legs is a consequence of the obstructive sleep apnea. And that often happens when someone's really struggling with their breathing. They end up getting a bit of restless legs. And so in that situation, you should fix the obstructive sleep apnea and then go back to fixing restless legs or other problems in the back of their throat. But I think that's a discussion for another day, I think. One of the other benefits of doing a drug-induced sleep endoscopy is that you tend to get better at operating on these patients. What's happening is that you do a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, you figure out what sort of operation you want to do for this person, and then you say to yourself, okay, I'll do this operation. But then if you bring them back afterwards, a lot of people get mostly better or slightly better, whatever you decided to do. And then you say, I'm going to come back in, say, 6 months' time and have a look at your throat afterwards just to see the effect of what my operation has done to your airway. So it really helps understand what each operation does for each person's airway. So I do a drug-induced sleep endoscopy before I do any operation, really. And so, say, I saw someone say, ah, look, you've got tonsils and the back of your tongue, and I'm going to do a little bit to your palate, say, something like that. I'll wait 6 months because I saw some other things on the drug-induced sleep endoscopy, but I want to see before I do those what it looks like. So I do the operation, then I wait 6 months, bring them back, do another drug-induced sleep endoscopy, and look down there. And then I can see the effect of what my operation had. And I say, oh, this really worked in this area here, but didn't work so well here. Maybe if I changed my technique or something like that, I could get better at doing that operation. Maybe my palate operation should be a bit tighter on the sides or a bit more lateral movement. There's all sorts of things that you can pick up. It's very hard to see that if you just look at your written notes. You actually need to look at the video before and after an operation. And when you do that, you can see how you're improving, see which operations do what to each person's throat, because there are 40 something, 42, 43 different operations I do for obstructive sleep apnea. I want to know what each of them does and how different patients seem to respond better to different operations. And so you can learn so much by a drug-induced sleep endoscopy because you can see the effect of each operation, what it does to individuals and their throat and how it opens them up. And also, you should do a sleep study before and after every operation so you can see the effect of your operation on the sleep study, on their throat, on the videos. And you can say also, if you keep doing this procedure, at the very start, I used to do a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, tell them what I found, say, look, this is the operation you need, come back and we'll do it for you as long as you're happy with that. And before I did the next operation, I said, well, we're going to do this operation as I promised you, but I'm just going to do another drug-induced sleep endoscopy just to prove to myself that what I saw the first time is what I saw now. I wanted to make sure that things didn't change each time, because if it changed, that would be a bit weird. That would mean that either I'm not getting the right stage of sleep or, things change throughout the night, which I haven't seen. What I was worried about was that the technique was poor and I was creating different levels of obstruction when really I want to make sure that the test, retest reliability, we call it, is good. It means that you see the same thing no matter how many times that you do it. And that's a good indication that you are having a good technique. That is a good indication that you're providing a really good technique and it's reliable, it's repeatable, And you can see the same things each time. Because sometimes I watch people do a drug-induced sleep endoscopy and I say, okay, let's just do it again using my technique. And they go, oh, it's very different. I said, let's do it again using your technique. And it looked different for them as well. And so what that does is it creates a whole lot of randomness. And then you're doing random operations because of it. And you're putting people through all these operations unnecessarily. So knowing that you see the same thing every time with your technique is really important. I have mentioned a few times that I would take a video of people's throats. And I think this is important to people who are starting this procedure, is because, you know, they say, oh, a picture is worth a thousand words. But if you imagine, if you're doing a video, that's probably a lot more words. And that's a simplistic way of looking at it. Because if you're looking at someone's throat, it's incredibly complex when they're snoring and sleeping, particularly if you see the cycle between deep sleep and then them choking, waking up, and going through the whole process all over again. Trying to provide that information on paper is really difficult. And so having a video of every single drug-induced sleep endoscopy and watching it back and forth between operations, you know, 6 months later, you might be seeing these patients. You won't remember what you did before. So having the video on a secure hard drive or on the secure network is really important because then you can see exactly what you saw last time. You know what part of this patient's throat you want to operate on and how much tension you need to put in different parts of the throat to open up their airway. I know there are a lot of classification systems out there. Typically, people use something called VOTE. I have even my own classification system, PTLTBE, which I've got a video on in my YouTube channel. But I don't think these are particularly useful. And I want to try and explain that. I'm not a great fan of VOTE at all. And I know lots of people have done lots of papers and publications on it. But the problem is that it's not very reliable. As I said before, I wanted the, when you're doing a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, you want to see the same results every time. There was a paper where everyone in the audience of this big sleep surgery conference were asked to look at a video and then do their VOTE classification on that video. So all of these experts on sleep surgery were there. They all did their own sort of interpretation of that video, and they all came up with different VOTE classifications for that video. And so that tells me that it's not very reliable. Lots of people would say different things. What is the point of these classification systems? I think they are useful for research because if you're trying to say, okay, how many people have a palate problem that causes flutter and a tongue-based problem or something like that, that you can see with a classification system like VOTE or my classification system, but it's not very useful if you just have that classification system. What you really need is the video, a brief description about what you actually saw. The classification system is really as a sort of research thing, and it is quite useful in some cases, but you shouldn't use it as a diagnostic tool. It's trying to narrow down all that information in that video or in that investigation down to a few numbers or a few letters. So it's a bit like saying, ah, oh, you've got obstructive sleep apnea. Your AHI is 20. That's what your problem is. But I've said lots of times in a lot of my videos that you shouldn't just look at the AHI. It's not a very good number. It's an average of averages. And what you're doing is trying to distill down all that information into one number. And it's not a good way of interpreting someone's sleep. You can't say your sleep score is 12 or 20 or whatever, because sleep is far more complex than that. The same thing happens with a drug-induced sleep endoscopy. The same thing happens to your throat. There's so much data in there to try and put it down to a few letters, four letters and a few numbers next to it isn't very useful. I created my classification system because it's more reliable. It's not more accurate or anything like that. It's just more reliable. It's a communication tool between colleagues. And so they sort of understand what's going on. But really, the only way to look at these things is to look at their videos and make sure that you know exactly what's going on in there. So I'm not a great fan of these classification systems at all. It's not, should not be used as a diagnostic tool. It's a communication tool only. It gives a brief outline of what's going on. But if you distill something down too much, you lose a lot of the detail that's useful in something so nuanced as medicine and surgery. So yes, classification systems are useful, but if you're going to use them, use a good one that works for you. And these classification systems for drug-induced sleep endoscopy, for me, are just a communication tool. They shouldn't be used as, ah, this is, I've seen what the VOTE system says. This is the operation I'm going to go for. Really, you need to look at the video. Otherwise, you're just losing so much detail that you're going to cause problems with your patients. So I'm going to quickly summarize what I've said now. I've talked about what drug-induced sleep endoscopy, what obstructive sleep apnea is, and how these procedures can help work out where the obstruction, where the restriction is in different parts of the throat. So with obstructive sleep apnea, you need to see where the obstruction is, and you need to see where the flutter is, which is causing the snoring. With upper airway resistance syndrome, for example, if you did a drug-induced sleep endoscopy on those people, and they don't really have an obstruction area, they have a restricted area, a narrowing of their airway. It's more of a sort of trying to breathe through a narrow airway. You need to see exactly where that narrow airway is. And you can see that with a drug-induced sleep endoscopy. I talked about the different types of drug-induced sleep endoscopy, the natural sleep endoscopy, the propofol infusion using midazolam or not using midazolam, and my technique where I try and give a tiny dose of propofol and then just wait for the effect of that drug to wear off so you can see what's going on in the back of the throat. I talked about some of the benefits of using my technique, so REM-associated sleep apnea and things like that, and seeing when people roll over, seeing the difference in their airways. You can use drug-induced sleep endoscopy before and after every operation to hone and improve your surgical techniques. And with time, what you'll do is you'll see, that area there, when I see that flapping around, or if I see that collapsing, when I do this operation or this technique, for me, it works really well in these sorts of patients with this BMI at this gender. And you end up having this big sort of Excel sheet with all the different operations you've done on different patients. And you slowly build up a picture of what works for you with your techniques and how they seem to improve and make your patients better. And by learning from your own techniques and how well you do your operations or how differently you do your operations from different people, you get to improve your technique, improve your outcomes, and make better decisions, give better outcomes for your patients. I was going to talk about the treatment options involved with this, but I think that's going to triple the length of this podcast, so I'm not going to do that. I do hope you found that useful. I will talk about treatment options probably next time. I didn't realize I'd be talking this long about just drug-induced sleep endoscopy. I hope you found that useful. Do take care. Bye-bye.